I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day.
The Sharp Show, featuring irreverent debates about politics, religion, and popular culture. Unscripted, with Sharp's off-the-cuff remarks occasionally provoking anger. Monday mornings, 8 to 9 a.m.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we're available via podcast, either through iTunes, where you can go to Public Radio and scan down to KUCI, or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can view prior guests, upcoming interviews, and access archives to past shows. They are up there now and available to you 24 hours a day for free. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Barbara will be back with you next week. Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week we bring you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, all those folks responsible for putting books out into the world, onto our shelves, and into our lives. This morning I'm joined by Dinah Lenny, and coming up in the second half hour, Michael Quadland will be here, so please stay with me for that. Dinah Lenny earned her bachelor's at Yale and a certificate of acting from the neighborhood Playhouse School before moving to L.A. to begin her acting career. Now in the middle of her 13th season as Nurse Shirley on NBC's critically acclaimed ER, she continues to work in theater and film and teaches arts in art programs at UCLA and Pepperdine. The co-author of Acting for Young Actors, Dinah holds an MFA in creative nonfiction from the Bennington Writers Seminars. Her essays appear in journals and anthologies, as well as her hometown newspaper, the LA Times. But this morning we'll be focusing our discussion on her latest book, Bigger Than Life, A Murder, A Memoir, published by the University of Nebraska Press, part of the American Lives series, and available in bookstores now. Dinah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me,
Martin. Thanks for coming on. Tell us first about Bigger Than Life, perhaps a brief introduction to the memoir and the subject of it.
You know, my father, his name was Nelson Gross, was murdered 10 years ago in a robbery gone bad. And before he was killed, I was sort of dabbling in fiction a bit. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that after my father died, I was unable to write really anything for a while. But when I did sit down to write again, the most compelling thing to me was my relationship with my father, was, you know, sort of trying to find a way to get inside that. And so the book comes from that time and the working out, you know, really from grieving.
Yeah, yeah. And was it apparent to you, when did it become apparent to you that you wanted to write this as a memoir, not and put it out into the world, and you know, in sort of a very public, kind of a public way to express your grief? When did you make that decision?
You know, it was one of those things where, you know, I think if you're a writer, you write and you don't think much about it. Certainly, I identified as an actor, but the writing was something that I'd always done, and it never went away. And then as I began to write about my father, because it was the best way for me, you know, Joan Didion says you write to find out what you think, or Patricia Hampel, another wonderful memoirist, says I write to find out what I know. Mm-hmm. And so I was writing, really, I think, to sort of clarify for myself what was going on, and it became, all of a sudden I had lots and lots of pages. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was sure it was a book, and I was equally sure that I wanted it to be nonfiction, that I wasn't going to clothe it, you know, in any kind of imaginary circumstances.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there was a discussion in the book about another family member, I think your father's brother, I believe, mm-hmm. Who talked about writing a similar book, but that obviously never came to pass.
No, it was funny. It was right after my father died that my Uncle Paul was very keen to write his story, and Paul is not a writer, but he really very much wanted to memorialize my father. He wanted to in some way sort of he wanted to write an extended eulogy, I think. And no, that book didn't come to pass. But it's funny that you ask about it, Marie, because I did think at the time, I can't write Paul's book. I'm going to write my own.
Yeah.
You know, there was although I wasn't ready to write anything at the time, there was that little sort of glimmer there of, nope, I've got something to say that's unique and belongs to me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the while your father's murder was certainly the driving force at the core of the novel and kind of provided the context for the story of your experience, the novel was, to me, as much about you processing your own childhood while straddling these two separate families.
Absolutely.
And you had your feet in two different camps. Maybe you could talk about that for just a minute, kind of the background of your childhood, and because to me that really was almost sharing the stage with what happened with your dad.
Yeah, I think, no question, I think that's right. This is not a biography, nor is it an autobiography. It's a memoir, and a memoir is about the person who's writing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, my parents were divorced when I was very, very young, and I was the only child from the original marriage. They both remarried quickly. I was brought up with my mother's kids, my mother and my stepfather's kids, and my stepfather raised me and was very, very important. It continues to be very important in my life. He's dad. So I was a person with two dads, and constantly swinging, you know, I mean, this was in the 60s before joint custody. so that I really was spending most of my time with my mother and my mother's family.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very, you know, consumed by this idea that I had, there was a whole other identity in the world for me.
Mm-hmm.
That had nothing to do with that. And that's an odd thing for a kid growing up, even if it's something you take entirely for granted, which I did. And you're right. The book is, the murder, my father's death was the catalyst for a series of recollections about what it means to grow up under those circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, did your father's murder, do you think, did that give you a context for which to explore a childhood that you'd already processed, or did you really process that during the writing of the book?
You know, I want to say that I had processed it, but I think I processed it all over again, mm-hmm. and with different sensibility, with it, you know, because I was mourning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was mourning somebody I knew and didn't know as well as I might have.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very painful for me.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it was wonderful. You know, I was recently on a panel with a writer who said that he thought that people who wrote for therapy, that it was probably bad therapy and bad writing. Whereas if you wrote to write something, to try to write something beautiful, that it might turn out to be good therapy. I hope, you know, I really hope I wrote a good book, and I hope it has some literary value. And it was certainly helpful to me. I did, you know, I did find out things about myself I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and in talking about whether or not, you know, it was a good literary book, which absolutely it was. The other interesting part of this to me was that you were so effective and good at creating the dramatic arc of fiction inside memoir. And I want to spend a few minutes talking about constructing the suspenseful arc of fiction inside a memoir when you're constrained by... you know, you're obviously constrained by the truth and by actual events that have to be worked with and manipulated into an order that holds the reader's attention.
Right.
And, you know, very unfortunately, the truth does lend itself, in this case, unfortunately, does lend itself to a very dramatic arc of its own. But
right.
I thought
right.
maybe you could talk about the process of how to order events, break up events, and organize them to create that suspenseful arc that keeps the reader reading.
Yeah, well, you know, I in the end, when I sort of sat down on the floor with this book, and that is literally what I did, I had, you know, little stacks, chapters, and it was a question of as you say, of organizing them, and as you know, the book is not linear. The biggest license I took, I think, is, and this is a big question with nonfiction as to whether or not you're allowed to do this or how you're allowed to do this. The biggest license I took was to write the conjecture chapter, the chapter mm-hmm. about where I imagine my father's murder,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of, you know, really introducing elements of fiction. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason I get away with that is because I'm there as the narrator saying, I'm making this up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. In terms of the bigger picture and suspense, yes, it was a struggle to sort of figure out how much information to withhold and how to let the thing unravel. Absolutely. And even I didn't know exactly where I was going. I didn't know that what would bookend the memoir was actually, you know, how to tell your children about tragedy.
Right.
How to tell your children about tragedy so that they can go on and live their lives like happy people.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I had no idea when I began that would be my frame.
Yeah, it was interesting that in the context of something that's so horrific, it was framed around, and the conclusion and the setup at the beginning was framed around, how do I tell these children, and how will they go on from that? And I thought that was a really unique play on on how to deal with what happened. I'm also curious about editing your own life, because when you're writing fiction and you have to invent every single little detail,
mm-hmm.
You're dealing with the opposite problem of when you're writing a memoir, I would think. You have this enormous body of material and background on people's lives and memories with your parents and backstory.
Mm-hmm.
And probably so much backstory, I'm imagining, that it must be a chore to decide what's serving the story, what's interesting, nevertheless extraneous. Was there a lot of material that you felt like you had to cut?
Yeah, there really was. That's a great question. That's sort of, that absolutely, there was tons to cut, because it wasn't, in the end, it wasn't the story of my life. And God knows, you know, we're all very fascinating to ourselves, and there were things mm-hmm. that I hated cutting, and I had good readers who said to me, "Yes, this is mildly interesting, but doesn't serve you." But yes, you know, it is not the story of my life. It's the story of this piece of my life, which includes my parents and my children. I mean, it is very sort of, you know, it's a big chunk. It's very inclusive, and like, I think, as with fiction, there are things you want to hint at maybe and not tell the whole thing.
Yeah,
you know, you maybe want to leave a little bit to your reader's imagination. Although it's, as you say, it's very different with nonfiction. But yes, there were huge business to cut. You know, I think if I went back again, I'd probably cut some more. You know, as you go back and read, you think, oh, well, this is a little bit, this is some fatty tissue here. We could excise this because you get some distance on it.
Yeah, what a tough process.
Yeah, but you know, ultimately, this is a terrible thing to say. It is a tough process. But 10 years later, I can tell you it's rewarding. And it's not unfun to write a book.
It's not,
you know,
unfun.
I mean, I'm sure I was writing about something terrible and I had some bad moments, but, you know, it was great.
Yeah.
I loved doing it.
I'm speaking with Dinah Lenny, author of Bigger Than Life, a memoir. Can you read to us now and kind of introduce our listeners to this world?
Sure. You know, and just before we started, we were talking, and you mentioned maybe starting at the beginning. And I've never done that when I've read from the book, but it's not a bad idea. So that's what I'll do. I'll just start at the beginning, and then I won't have to say much, except that my daughter's name is Eliza, and my son's name is Jake, and my husband is Fred.
Excellent.
And I'll start. This is the prologue. The chapter is called Eliza Wants to Know. Mm. Eliza wants to know about all kinds of sex. "So what's your take on oral, Mom?" she asks. "Giving and receiving," she adds, climbing onto a stool at the kitchen counter. Eliza is 13 now. She's taking health as a science in her seventh grade year in a program for 210 allegedly gifted children at a local public school. "Do old people have sex?" she wants to know. No, Mom, not like you and Dad. I mean old people," she clarifies. She wonders when, if ever, she will have a boyfriend, and when, if ever, I think it will be appropriate for her to have sex. "Don't worry," she comforts me, having confided that a girl in her P.E. class might be pregnant. "I know I'm not ready yet. But just tell me, Mom, when did you first kiss a boy, anyway?" Eliza wants to know, wants to know, wants to know. Eliza reads the headlines in the New York Times most mornings with her orange juice and cinnamon toast. She reminds me over and over that she is more capable than I give her credit for, more mature, more deserving. And she daydreams about her own cell phone and her own car, and colleges and cities clear across the continent. "Did you ever smoke cigarettes, Mom?" she asks. "Did you ever smoke pot? Do you believe in marijuana for medicinal purposes? How do you feel about the death penalty? How do you feel about the Israeli settlements? We're Democrats, right?" Eliza scoffs when I warn or explain, suggest or advise. I know, she interrupts. "I'm not dumb, Mom," she insists, "and you're overprotective, she says on a sigh. I remind her every so often we live in a big, dangerous city, and it continues to be my job to take care of her to the best of my ability, at least for the time being. Eliza knows the world isn't safe. She knows about war and famine and poverty and crime. She knows that thousands of children lost parents when the World Trade Towers collapsed. But she doesn't know, she doesn't yet know, that her own grandfather was murdered nearly 6 years ago, and I am not ready to tell her. Jake, on the other hand, who is 10, needs not to know. He'd prefer us to stay upstairs until he falls asleep at night rather than going down to bed ourselves. What worries you, sweetie, I ask when I kiss him goodnight in the dark. Oh, you know, Mommy says, the usual, kidnapping and robbery. As much as Eliza needs the truth under most circumstances, that's how badly Jake needs to believe he is safe. He dreams about terrorists, about dark caves and abducted children. We assure him again and again that there are more good people than bad, and that nothing will happen to anyone he loves. Whether his fears are age-appropriate, I cannot say for sure. But I remember when I was a kid asking my mother to promise me she would not die. I promise, she said. And I wonder now, was she as uncomfortable making that sort of promise as she should have been, as I should be when I promise my son the very same thing? Because it's disconcertingly easy for me to shake off the doubt, the discomfort. For one thing, this is what my boy needs to hear, and for another, I believe what I say. How naive, how arrogant, how foolish to tempt fate, to pretend even for a moment I can predict with any certainty that I will live to be old. Because even knowing that the towers came down, that we anticipate the big one in Southern California every day, that breast cancer claims friends and neighbors with terrifying regularity, that there's a fatality on the freeway during every rush hour, that my own father was kidnapped and killed with a pocket knife. Even so, and in spite of all that, I intend to live practically forever, and any other conclusion is unimaginable, unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. What is this utter denial of the facts, of the news, of my own mortality? Is this optimism? Is it part of my essentially American sense of entitlement? Should I be reading up on Buddhism and other Eastern methodologies? In any case, it seems to go hand in hand with my unwillingness to accept that life could turn out to be anything less than wonderful, my indignation in the face of disappointment, my swallowing of turbulence and tragedy, and my faith in impossibly complete recovery after the fact. Nobody tells us when we're children that life is difficult and unfair. Instead, we middle-class American kids were told we could be anything we wanted to be, do anything we wanted to do, and we tell our own children the same. As sad as we are, scarred and uncertain as we are, we believe what we tell them. As a generation, as a culture, we're certifiable. We ought to be locked away.
Mm. That's great. That was Dinah Lenny reading from her latest memoir, Bigger Than Life. You were quite candid in the book about some fairly strenuous relationships you had with some members of your, mainly on your father's side of the family. Did those relationships haunt you as you were writing the memoir, or was it a release, and have there been any significant aftermath in the wake of the release of the book?
I am so glad you asked that. I have not, there are tons of people I have not heard from, but one of the relationships that I write about in the book is my relationship with my uncles, as you know, because I was estranged from them for a very long time, and certainly in the course of writing the book, and these were over issues having to do with my father's will that were difficult. And one of the things that was incredible after the book came out was that I got a phone call. I was at a writing conference in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was really the first sort of momentum was gathering around the book, and it was out. And I got a call from my aunt and my uncle, who I hadn't spoken to in 10 years, mm-hmm. and I was very nervous. I thought, here it comes. There's going to be a lawsuit. There's going to be something. Here we go. And my aunt said to me on the phone, We finished your book, and we love it, and it's wonderful, and you got it all right, and we miss you, and we want to see you, and we want to know your children. It was really gratifying.
Wow.
That was something. My mother gets a pretty rough rap in this book, and she's had a very tough time with it. Mm. And Eliza, of course, doesn't like the opening one bit.
But, of course, right.
But, by and large, I'm sure, I have not heard from my stepmother. I don't expect to.
Right, right.
And I really did try to tell the truth, which was one of the gratifying things about hearing from this aunt and uncle.
Yeah, it's nice to have something out there, I would imagine, that tells your side of the story, and they can choose to read it or not.
Yeah, and I do say, in the beginning, my mom said to me, well, she said, I don't agree with everything in this book, but this is your perception, and you're entitled to your perception. And then, of course, when it appeared between two covers, that was slightly more difficult for her. There's also plenty in the book that's a tribute to her. I mean, she did wonderful, wonderful things for me. She handled a very difficult situation very beautifully in lots of ways. But, at some point with memoir, you do have to say, people, you're going to have to write your own.
Right.
You got to write your own book because this is mine.
Right, right. That's great. Right. I'm always curious to hear how writers are motivated, what motivates them to write. And so many of our guests on the show have been, they were writing out of the womb and had this compulsion from, before birth. So I'm always intrigued by those who've led other rich lives in other fields and then are drawn to the page later in life. What drew you here?
You know, I think, first of all, I think that writing and acting are very similar, at least for me. They come from a very similar place, having to do with wanting to make your mark and be your most intense self, really. I think there's this sort of erroneous idea out there that actors metamorphize in some way, that we transform ourselves. And in reality, that's maybe true of a small percentage of people who are incredibly gifted or incredibly troubled. And for the rest of us, acting is really about allowing us to own feelings that would otherwise, you know, people are always saying, well, you're so intense or you're so dramatic or you're so emotional. And acting allows you to be all those things, as does writing. Writing allows you to make a mark, to say this is meaningful, this is important, and I own this. So in that sense, I think I probably, I think they're compatible, the two things. And the other thing is that I did always dabble in the writing. But what's interesting to me is that when I came up, when I was going to college, I took a writing class with a wonderful guy named John Hersey, who was a novelist, but also a journalist, and wrote both fiction and nonfiction. And he taught two classes at Yale, and one was in journalism, one was in fiction. I applied to journalism, and he called me on the phone and said, "You'll never be a journalist. You take things too personally. But you can be in my fiction class." So I went to his fiction class, and it turned out I wasn't very good at that either, because I take things too personally. So I think, you know, this business of, it's an awful term, I guess, but this business of creative nonfiction is really, it really speaks to me, you know, this idea of taking things personally on the page. And in that way, again, you know, it's an extension of what I was already doing as an actor.
Yeah.
Allowing myself to take things personally.
Very interesting. Yeah, I was curious about whether or not you feel that your acting is somehow in dialogue with your writing or somehow informs it, and it's interesting to hear your thoughts on that.
It definitely does as a teacher, for sure. I mean, I teach both, and they inform each other for sure.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which is nice.
Yeah. You also had a great technique in here in the book that was an acting technique, but I think it's also a great writerly technique, where you bring your character up onto stage by himself and make him tell you what he wants. And
yeah, and actually that came out of, that was my husband. My husband was a writing, you know, he was a screenwriter at the time, and he was taking a playwriting class, and that came out of his play, you know, it was his teacher who said, "Put your character on the stage and ask him what he wants." You know, and yes, I did use it, and it was fun.
Yeah, it's a great exercise, and I love how you start off with, "I want somebody to clean my windows," and I want all the stuff that you think you at first want.
Which is still true, Maria.
Which is true.
I'm still looking at these windows and wanting somebody to clean them. Absolutely.
Great. Do you have any last words of wisdom or advice for a lot of our listeners or writers out there? Maybe
yes.
A few of them are actors. I don't know.
I don't have a ton of wisdom to impart here, but I will say, stay with it and believe in what you're doing. And you know, this book was not easy to get out there, and it was not easy to sell. And your writing will have a life. Don't give up on it. That's what I would say.
Great, Dinah. Thank you.
Thank
for being
you
here.
So much for having me. It's been fun.
This was fun. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Michael Quadlin, so please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hey, Arden.
So, we should get a promo for our show.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
But it has to be clever.
What should we do?
I don't know. I'm not that clever, man.
Me either.
All right, well, our show's on Saturdays from 2 to 4 p.m.
Yeah.
And, yeah, okay.
And we have lots of live bands.
I guess that wasn't that clever. Oh, well.
Too bad we weren't recording this.
And you're listening to Peace and Unity.
And your mom.
Dude, did you see the Factor last night? Bill ripped on those hippie traders.
Totally.
I was watching PBS last night. Oh, I mean, Survivor! I was watching Survivor!
Dude, those liberals are so stupid.
Totally.
Why do they hate America?
Does this happen to you? Tired of the same old Republican talking points shouted at you all day long by ditto heads and Republicans? Don't know what to do? Now you do, hippie! Listen to the Mojo Wire every other Saturday at 8:25 a.m. when liberal brawlers sound off on the news. This is your rhetorical club for these dark times.
Yeah, dude, I was totally watching Fox News. And wait, what's that liberal doing? Oh my God, they're listening to the Mojo Wire! Run! Put me alive! Run!
The Mojo Wire, brought to you by the Darklink Eclectica here on KUCI 88.9 FM.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will be back with you again next week. Michael Quadland grew up in Williamstown, Massachusetts. He graduated from Dartmouth, received a Master's of Public Health degree from Yale and a Ph.D. in Psychology from NYU. In addition to his private psychotherapy practice, he taught human sexuality at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City, supervised a sex information hotline in Manhattan, and consulted with many organizations about AIDS prevention and the psychological aspects of the disease. He was a founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis, the world's largest AIDS organization, and has published many articles in professional journals regarding AIDS and sexuality. The LA Times published his nonfiction article, A Red X, about the death of a friend. Quadlin left AIDS work in 1995, reduced the size of his psychotherapy practice, and restored an 18th century farmhouse in Connecticut, doing much of the work himself. He also turned to writing fiction. He now divides his time between New York City and Northwest Connecticut. That Was Then is Michael's first novel, available now and published by Red Hen Press. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's fun to have you on. Before we get into the book, I'm always intrigued by writers who came to writing later in life, after fruitful careers in other fields and lives lived apart from books and what draws people to novel writing. You were a psychologist and seemed to have a very, you know, active and involved life in other pursuits prior to writing. So I'm wondering if you can talk for a moment about the events that led you to write.
Sure. Well, you know, I had written a number of, as you said, nonfiction articles for journals. But I, as you said, also came to writing fiction late in life. I hadn't really been much of a reader, never mind a writer, as a young man. So this was something quite different. As you also mentioned in my biography, I had worked in AIDS work for 14 years, which was very intense. Most of the people I knew, friends and colleagues, died over the course of those 14 years. And it was at the end of that time that, after 14 years in 1995, that I turned to writing fiction. And I think there were two reasons that it appealed to me that were not so conscious at the time, but in retrospect I think were quite important. One was the fact that writing fiction was so challenging and difficult. And coming from what I had come from, I was trading one challenging endeavor for another one, and needed that in order to move on. And the second reason is that writing fiction gives you a great sense of control. You create a crisis for a character, put him in it, and then you take control over what happens. And that was very appealing, having come, I think, from something that felt so totally out of control and chaotic.
Interesting. Do you feel like your prior life experiences inform your fiction? What do you draw upon most in either the discipline of the craft of fiction or the material itself from what you experienced prior?
Well, I certainly do draw on my own life experiences. It's been interesting to see how many people actually have seen the novel as autobiographical in the 6 weeks that it's been out, particularly people who know me. It is not actually that heavily autobiographical. The parts that do refer to my life are highly fictionalized. But I was sharing this with a friend of mine whom you know, Lynette Brassfield, who's written a wonderful book called Nature Lessons a few years ago about a girl growing up with a schizophrenic mother. And I was complaining to Lynn about the fact that everyone was seeing my book as autobiographical. And she wrote back to me an email, which I'll share a quote for you, which she said, "You can't help that people are so disinclined to accept that fiction is fiction, though born of deep emotional truth. They will always believe what they want to believe." And it's that phrase, born of deep emotional truth, that really touched me, because I think that is what you'll find of me in this book, more than the facts or what happens. It's the emotional truth that's there.
Yeah, I love, Lynette always has a great gift for getting to the kernel of truth in things succinctly.
It's so true. She's a very wise person and very helpful to me.
She is, yeah.
And the other thing about what informs my fiction certainly is my practice. You know, I hear, what I do is listen to people's stories. You know, so I hear lots of stories, and I would never use one of those directly, of course, because that would be unethical, but it is certainly a richness that stirs around in my head and ultimately would inform my fiction, I'm sure.
Yeah, I want to go back to what we were talking about and Lynette's words of advice, because we were talking about this on the show last week as well. Emily Listfield wrote a novel heavily based on personal experience, but fictionalizing life and drawing elements from certain discrete life experiences and then spinning them out into fictionalized novels, so the result is something either, you know, similar to your actual experience with twists, or perhaps ultimately unrelated to reality in the end, though it feels like it as Lynette said, it feels like it has an emotional authenticity that perhaps you couldn't get at any other way.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm interested in mining. Does mining from your certain aspects of your life give the novel that emotional authenticity for you, which, you know, utterly fictionalizing it would not do? Or what motivated you to draw from certain life experiences to spin out something that turned out to be completely different from your actual experience?
I think, mind you, I wrote this novel, I finished it 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's more true in my earlier writing than it is now, that I really used my own experience and needed that experience to get into the writing itself.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then go with it. But I think that is part of what makes it authentic, is that I start from myself and from a person I know or a person I can, have known becomes a character. And, of course, that person changes inevitably as the work continues. But, it very much was a starting point for me with this novel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We should back up. I realize that we haven't even talked about you introducing the novel. I'm talking with Michael Quadland, author of That Was Then. So tell us about the subject matter of the book and how it came to be.
Okay. I had a client, I'm a psychologist, as you mentioned, I had a client come into my office a couple of weeks ago and sit down and say, I heard a definition of a midlife crisis. And I said, really, what is it? And he said, it's someone who's climbed to the top of the ladder and realized that he's leaned his ladder against the wrong wall. And I thought that was very apt. And Corey Moore, the protagonist of the novel, he's a little young for a midlife crisis. He's in his mid-30s. But he has leaned his ladder not so much against the wrong wall, but only one wall of a room, let's say. Successful professionally and financially, and he has a thriving career, but he's completely and utterly lost emotionally. Mm-hmm. He's shut down. And he runs into his childhood girlfriend on the street in New York, whom he hasn't seen in 20 years, and they rekindle their relationship. And not long after that, he meets her best friend, Jack, who's an actor. And the relationships that develop among the three of them, particularly between Corey and Gina and Corey and Jack, really wakes Corey up and causes him to feel more and think a lot more and to reclaim really that aspect of that emotional aspect of his life that he'd let go of years before. So it's really about Corey's search for the truth about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that process of finding the truth about oneself is a really interesting one for me. It's, of course, what I do as a therapist. I help people do that. But I think it's a very difficult thing to pin down because we inevitably distort the truth, I think, when we try to focus on it, because all we have really are our own one-sided perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a difficult process and probably an impossible one ultimately, but I think one worth doing because, like any other endeavor, it's the what happens along the way that's most important.
Right, right.
And I think men in particular have a problem in this regard. I mean, the kinds of questions like, who am I really? What's important to me? What am I like as a father or a partner or a friend? These are really difficult questions, I think, particularly for men, because we're taught to kind of put our heads down early on in life and just keep going and not ask too many provocative questions.
Mm-hmm.
And these questions, they're scary because they have the potential to take us somewhere different from where we are now.
Right, right. How did the idea for the novel begin for you? Was it character-driven with Corey? Was there an image that came to you or an... we've talked about ideas that you wanted to explore in it, but did it start with the character of Corey, or did it start with something else, or an idea, or?
Well, both in a way. I mean, it started with the idea. I mean, there's been so much talk for the last 10 years, really, about childhood sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's been such an issue in the press and in our minds that it the idea of what an adult who had had this experience as a child would be like, what would his life look like? That was an interesting thought to me. So actually I wrote the novel kind of in two parts, the backstory of Corey's relationship with the teacher as a young adolescent, and then more wrote the front story, keeping in mind that experience and how it would affect him as an adult.
Yeah, I want to talk about how the novel was written. Actually, maybe I will have you read to us now, and then that can take us into a discussion about the construction of the novel itself.
Okay.
I'm speaking with Michael Quadland, author of That Was Then, published by Red Hen Press.
I'm just, I wasn't prepared for this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I caught you off guard there. You know, while we're waiting for you to find your spot, it was interesting when the way the novel was constructed, as you said, was done in two parts. It was the backstory and interwoven with present. Well, it wasn't present day. It takes place in the 80s, but present tense time with Corey as an adult. Did you write that? Did you write them separately? Did you write everything that happened in the 1960s? Separately from writing everything that happened present day, or did you write it pretty much in the way that it came out with the back and forth through time?
No, it was. They were written, I would say, more separately, although there are certainly some of both. But I wrote most of the backstory first.
Okay.
And later on wrote the front story and decided how the backstory would be interspersed in that story to make it make sense.
Yeah, it's so dramatically, you know, the spaces obviously where you left off are such dramatic points, and it feels so natural, and it feels like what's going on in the present is informed by, at that point in time in the novel, what went on in the past. And so it's the construction of it, you know, it almost feels as though you wrote it back and forth. I guess that's the goal in novel writing, is to make it feel so natural, but really well done.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That was, certainly was was the objective there.
Mm. It has to be challenging. I would think if you have all of these, you know, fragments of things happening here and there, laying out on your floor, however you do it, to construct them into a story that flows so well. We can talk about that too, how you went about that process. But did I catch you off guard in the reading?
I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
Mentioned that, and I completely forgot about it. And I'm doing a reading at the local library this evening, and they were short on copies, so I just dropped off every copy.
Oh, no worries. No worries at all. No worries at all. Yeah, I'm...
I'd love to hear you read it.
No one wants to hear me. The other thing that I thought was, well, maybe we'll go into the craft and talk about the construction and structure of the novel and how you went about structuring it and putting it together. So it sounds like it was written in, was it written in fragments, or talk about that a little bit?
It was certainly written in two parts, as I said, and one, the backstory was written first. So let's see. And as I said, it occurred to me as I was writing that story to wonder about what the adult might look like who had had this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So they were written pretty much sequentially. And as I said, as I was writing the front story, I was looking for how I would intersperse the backstory with that, so that.
So one would inform the other.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, I think one of the many strengths of this novel is that although it's written in first person from a very particular viewpoint, you deal with every character with such empathy and fairness and kind of this gentle understanding, even, you know, characters that aren't the most desirable folks or who
Right.
have obvious flaws. Was that difficult to do, or did it come about naturally? It almost feels as though you spent time as the author writing from different characters' points of view to really understand them and their motivations. But how difficult was it to get into an empathetic feeling for characters who you perhaps, you know, it's presented challenges, I would say.
Right. I think it, even though they don't appear in the novel, I did write, I did have to take the experience of writing from different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I first started working on the backstory, the story about the relationship between the teacher and the boy, I thought about it actually as a stage piece.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, in which they would, in fact, started writing it that way, in which you'd have two characters sharing the stage, the boy and the teacher, and telling that the story of the same experience, but from their different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did spend a good deal of time thinking about what this was about for the teacher,
mm-hmm.
this experience. And, you know, I've seen people who have had these kinds of experience with young people. I've seen them in my office. And what I have found that really impresses me about these people is that they think, often anyway, they think that they're helping the child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These children are often quite needy and are not getting the attention they need at home. And so the adult thinks that he's actually helping the child and loving them. That's obviously a distortion of what's really happening,
mm-hmm.
but it also is a part of what's happening, I think.
Yeah.
So I tried to put myself in the teacher's position and write from and as an exercise, write from his point of view, and I think it was helpful.
Yeah, I experienced great empathy for him, and I certainly didn't see him as a bad guy, and I think that's a huge credit to your writing.
That was very much a goal of mine in this work. I think that while I believe that sex between an adult and a child is always wrong, and it's always wrong because the child is just not prepared to have that kind of experience and make a decision to have it, as the power relationship is so different. So while I think it's always wrong, it's also true, I think, that it's complicated.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
A lot of these adults are people who have been abused themselves as children. And as I said, they think they're helping. It's just complicated. And I think the victim-perpetrator point of view, while it's in part true, is an oversimplification. And I wanted to explore that further.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the essential part of fiction is exposing the complexities of the sort of thorny issues that people feel strongly about or have strong reactions to that they, you know, they think they know the answer to, and the goal of fiction is to say there's more going on here than that.
And, absolutely, I think that's very true, and I think every writer of fiction hopes that their writing will be in some small way transformative for
mm-hmm.
people who are reading it, and that is certainly one of the things I wanted people to have to think about.
Yeah. It was interesting in an interview, the interview actually on your website, a great website, your name, michaelquadland.com, there's a great interview with you up there where you talk about... I just lost my train of thought. This happens to me frequently. But you talk about, I think the question was that some of the sexual abuse scenes were hard to read, and were they hard to write? And you had said, no, they really weren't. And for me, they really weren't that hard to read because you did it, like I say, with such empathy and grace. But you said that the hard parts to write and the hard parts to read for me were when characters were missing each other.
Yeah, that to me was the most painful part because I think, you know, in fact, in life, it is so painful when you reach out to someone and they're not really there or someone reaches out to you and you can't respond. I think those are some of the most painful moments in life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And those were so nicely drawn in this. The other thing that I thought was great is the sense of place in this novel. You live in the places where the novel happens,
right?
Which obviously helps. but it feels very anchored in a time and place. Was living where the novel was set an essential element for you? Can you imagine writing about a time or a place where you haven't lived, or, you know, how much did you, I assume you drew?
I can't imagine that. In fact, I have never been to Nebraska.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And you remember that that's where Corey goes to find Jack, and they have their encounter there.
Yeah, that was very well, wow.
Well, so that, I looked at a map, and I was looking for a place that was really sparsely populated, and I pictured it as being flat and kind of grim.
Mm-hmm.
So but probably is not that, but that was my picture of it. So that was an exercise I made for myself to write about a place that I've never even seen. But I love writing about New York.
Mm-hmm.
I find it such a rich environment. So, and of course, I know it well, having lived there for 25 years.
Yeah. New York is it is fun to write about. And there's no place in the world like New York. It's great.
For better or worse.
Yeah, exactly. It was also interesting to me, you know, it seems like in some sense gay literature dealing with those issues and set in the 1980s, it either directly confronts AIDS or it sort of has it as the elephant in the living room if it doesn't.
Yeah.
And while that was obviously an enormous concern, particularly during that time period, there are obviously, you know, other issues to tackle. Nonetheless, did you feel any internal or external pressure to address it? Was it a concern, or was it's not in the novel, but did it become an issue for you, or was it simply a non-issue for you?
It became an issue. I was so absorbed in telling the story that I it didn't really occur to me until quite late in the process that, oh my God, you know, this, I've set this thing at the very height of the epidemic, and there's not even a mention of it.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like a huge omission, particularly for me, who had been, you know, so involved in the AIDS epidemic. So,
mm-hmm.
And then it seemed like, well, this is no accident. You're just not ready to go there, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the reason. That was a very difficult a challenging time for me emotionally. And when my best friend died in 1995, and he and I had worked alongside each other in the epidemic, and he was one of the founders of the GMHC.
Mm-hmm.
Before he died, he said to me, you know, you're probably the only one of us who's going to survive. And by us, he meant the founders of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you're going to have to tell people what we did. And I nodded, of course. It was, you know, his dying wish. And I hadn't been able to do it. And I think I'm just now, I've been thinking a lot about that since this novel came out, and I believe that I've reached the point where I can start writing about that time.
Mm, amazing. We're drawing down on the clock here, but do you have any last words of advice for some of our writerly listeners?
I would love to be able to read to them.
I would love that, too.
I can't believe I did that. I'm sorry.
No worries.
I guess I would say if you want to write, to me, the best way to learn how to write is to write.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think I said this, too, it's certainly one of the most challenging things I've ever attempted to do, and also the most satisfying on those occasions when you finally get something right. You know, a paragraph or a page, it feels great. But, I would just, I am not someone who's academically trained as a writer, and I think that is both, limits me in some ways, hurts me in some ways, but also I feel sort of free of those intellectual constraints, if you will.
Those pesky rules, yeah.
Exactly. But I'm one who believes that the way to become a therapist is to do therapy, and the way to play the piano is to play the piano, and I think that about writing, too.
Yeah, great. Michael, thank you for taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Michael Quadland, author of That Was Then, available now and published by Red Hen Press. A quote from Catherine Drinker Bowen will take us out this morning. Writing, I think, is not apart from living. Writing is a kind of double living. The writer experiences everything twice, once in reality, and once in the mirror, which waits always before or behind. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you again next Wednesday morning at 9. So until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day. I just don't wanna be free, no.